Okay, let's see if that's going to work. Okay. Hopefully that sounds better to you than it does to us. Because I had quite an echo there for a second. All right, that's right. Pepper Daniels in for Craig Hill. I don't know who programs this station anyway. Matt,
I thought
Hoyt.
It was you.
Matt, it is me. Matt, welcome back on this Friday. I'm going to get out of the way and let you do your thing. Tell us what you got lined up for today.
We are starting out today with Michael Semenchik. He is the managing attorney for the California Innocence Project. Want to talk with him about what he does, kind of what he feels about the decision by our governor to put a moratorium on all death penalty executions in the state. Michael, good to have you here.
Hi, man.
First off, can you give our listeners some kind of background on yourself and how you became to be involved with the California Innocence Project?
Sure. I've been at the California Innocence Project as an attorney since 2011. I got involved when I was in law school. I was in my first week of law school at California Western School of Law here in San Diego, and I was sitting in a room listening to a conversation between Timothy Atkins and a bunch of students. And Tim Atkins had recently been released from prison. He spent 23 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. And at the time, I was 23 years old, so I was sitting in the room thinking, how could somebody have spent my entire life in prison for something he didn't do? And Tim told the room that actually there were thousands more. So I found my way into the project and worked as a student and then continued to work after I finished law school. And as soon as I got my bar results, got hired on. And I've been here since. And I've worked on a lot of cases and done a bunch of different tasks and jobs and supervised students and looked into all different sorts of issues that come up in this line of work. And so I'm happy to be here and talk to you guys about the criminal justice system and in particular the death penalty.
Okay. So what's the goal of the California Innocence Project? What do you guys do day in, day out?
So we get 2,000 requests for assistance from inmates all over California who are claiming
state
innocence.
Or federal or both?
Well, it's state and federal court, so they could be convicted anywhere in California.
Okay.
But our mandate is specific to California. And more specifically, we focus on Southern California, so San Luis Obispo and Kern County, and then south, going south from there. And the Northern California Innocence Project handles cases from the northern part of the state. And so we split the state in half, and in our office, we get 2,000 requests for assistance, typically on average, per year. And it's inmates all over the state claiming that they are in prison and they're innocent. And it's our job to figure out, one, if we do believe that they are innocent, then we'll... And we can prove it, then we'll file in court and try to get them out.
Okay. So, again, the big news this week is Governor Gavin Newsom deciding to put kind of a blanket moratorium on executions. I'm not sure how much that really matters, considering, and correct me if I'm wrong, we haven't executed anyone in this state since 2006?
Correct.
Okay. Was there anyone in line at this point? I mean, I know in theory that everyone on death row is in line, but were there any kind of imminent executions? Were there any dates set for any time in the near future?
Well, so the current status, and actually his moratorium doesn't change this status, but I can explain that. So essentially,
yeah, please
go ahead. There were 25 people that that their appeals. There's 25 individuals of the 737 on California's death row where their appeals had become final, and there were no additional appeals to be filed. And so those are death ready, I guess, if you will. They're ready to be executed, but for the fact that we've actually not there's additional ongoing litigation with regard to the lethal injection protocols in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And so even despite the fact that those appeals are done, the state is actually not proceeding with any executions at the moment because of the lethal injection protocols and trying to figure out how they would go about carrying out these death sentences.
What's the problem with that, if you can explain that to our listeners?
It's a complicated issue. Basically comes down to, is it cruel and unusual punishment?
Okay.
And so under the Eighth Amendment, which bars cruel and unusual punishment, the question always has been, what do we consider cruel and unusual? Does the person, when they're being executed, do they feel pain? And who's to judge that? And so that's always been one of the big issues with carrying out a death sentence. And then there's other issues as well, as far as, like, where do the drugs come from? Are the drugs coming into the state legally? And so there was a time where a bunch of states were having issues obtaining the drugs legally, and so they were going out of country, actually, and illegally importing drugs. And then there's secrecy laws around it. They're not disclosing what drugs they're actually using and not disclosing where they're getting them. And so there's a big fight over how to actually carry these things out. And it's somewhat tied to the Eighth Amendment, but also,
some other legal shenanigans.
Exactly.
Okay. So briefly outline for me, if you would, the California Innocence Project's kind of position on the death penalty. Is it something that should never be used, or explain it to us?
Yeah, it's something that our position is we shouldn't have the death penalty. And the reason is fairly simple, is that we don't want to risk executing the innocent. We know now that a conservative estimate suggests that at least 4% of people on death row are innocent, so about 1 in 25 are innocent. Some estimates are as high as 10% of people are innocent and in prison. And so, you know, when you're looking at 737 people, that's approximately, with a conservative estimate, we're looking at 29 people would be executed that didn't do it. We know last year alone we had an individual that actually walked off California's death row after having been on death row for 26 years. Mm-hmm. And so
tell us about that case, if you would.
It wasn't our case. Wasn't a case that I worked on, and I'm not actually all that familiar with the facts of the case. I don't want to, you know, try to say that I know what the case is about and not know. But I can just say that there's been 164 people that have walked off death rows in the United States since 1978, and those 164 people all have individual cases, and they all had individual facts, and all of those cases ultimately had problems. They all had one thing in common: it's that they all ended up on death row despite their innocence. Mm-hmm. And that is the reason that we as an organization have to be against the death penalty. We believe that there are somewhere between 4 and 10% of people in prison are innocent and aren't supposed to be there, and we don't want to be executing those folks. So
what's your opinion on Governor Newsom's kind of blanket moratorium? This a good thing, bad thing?
I think it's a good thing, because and he started his press conference talking about a wrongful conviction, that he had actually known somebody from a young age. He recognized that there were people on California's death row that were innocent, and that's kind of one of the reasons that he came out and said that he was, you know, putting forth this moratorium through executive order was that risk. So we're definitely in support of that reasoning for why to shut it down.
Okay, let me throw something out at you and just kind of get a response, because this is my feeling on it. I am personally not strongly for the death penalty. I'm also not strongly opposed to it. I think there are certain situations that are so heinous that's what those people deserve for the crimes they've committed. Here's where I've got a problem. Over the past 6 or so years, once I believe in 2012 and once in 2016, this was put before the voters of the state of California, and in both cases they wanted to continue with the death penalty. And I see this similar to Barack Obama's kind of blanket decision not to prosecute anyone who entered the country illegally as a child under DACA. I see this similar to Terry McAuliffe in Virginia's decision, where he has the right to restore voting rights to felons on a case-by-case basis, but he was doing it, you know, as a blanket. You know, everyone gets your voting rights back. I see it as similar to, you know, frankly, Donald Trump, and he didn't get his way on the wall, so he, you know, does a executive order set declaring an emergency, so he gets to get his way on the wall anyways. I'm concerned about process and the constitutional rules and the way those things are set up, and I'm worrying that we too often ignore them or dismiss them if the result we get is the one we want.
Right. And just to speak to that, and there are differences between all of those examples that you just gave. And, you know, I think we'd be talking for quite a while if I were to go through each and every one of those. But just to talk about a few of them, I mean, to contrast that with what the governor's done with what the president has recently done, they're totally different things. And here's why. The governor is constitutionally given the power to issue a reprieve on each and every single case, each and every single execution that comes across his desk. He is the person, he gets that power, mm-hmm. It's granted to him, to decide, should I sign off on this execution, on this death warrant, or should I not? And what he's done here, he's not eliminated the death penalty. In fact, somebody could be tried and convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to death tomorrow. There's nothing stopping that. The law is still the same. It's still intact. What he's done, and that with through his executive order, is he said, I'm not going to sign a single death warrant that comes across my desk, and that's his right. And so that's entirely different from the way that President Trump is approaching the current situation with the border, where Congress typically is the body that allocates the funding for projects, and the president's trying to get funding through a separate means,
right. But the Congress also gave him the authority to declare emergencies, and that's what he's gone and done.
Right. But there's certain rules with regard to the emergencies, and I think it's not a blanket rule to declare. There actually has to be an emergency, so it's not as black and white as it is with our governor in this situation. That you can't just say, oh, I'm going to declare a national emergency and give everyone in the federal government a raise of, you know, an outrageous raise and pay them more money, for example. He can't just make up rules and decide to spend money in any way he wants. There's specific things that he has to do, and one is to actually show that there is an emergency, and pretty quickly after he declared it, he admitted that there wasn't actually an emergency. So, I mean, that's a totally separate case and totally separate issue, but I think the point is this governor has the ability to. There's no doubt about it. I think he's on strong legal footing and legal grounds to issue a reprieve, for a blanket reprieve, because he has that power. It's given to him specifically. He's the last person that has to sign off on these death warrants, and if he chooses not to, he chooses not to. Now, even considering all that, let's say that Gavin Newsom loses the next election. The next governor, whoever that may be, can certainly start signing off on death warrants. There's no, and the executions can continue. So,
right.
That the law is still intact. They can still be convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to death. And all of those individuals that are currently sitting on death row, they're still going to be sitting in prison, and they are technically going to be death eligible for the length of Newsom's time in office.
We're talking with Michael Semenchik. He is the California Innocence Project managing attorney. You can find him on the World Wide Web at CaliforniaInnocenceProject.org. You're listening to the Dave Congleton Show on 920 AM, 96.5 FM, KVEC. We'll be right back after this. You're listening to the Dave Congleton Show. Matt Hoy sitting in for Dave. Dave is going to be back on Monday. So we're looking forward to that. We're talking with Michael Semenchik, the managing attorney, California Innocence Project. If you want to get in on the conversation, give us a call, 805-543-8830. That's the number that you can also text us on the Stolberg Law KVEC text line, or 1-800-549-5832. If you've got a question for him about the death penalty, how what the California Innocent Project does, that sort of stuff, we'd love to hear from you. Michael, so walk us through kind of the process you go through when someone kind of figuratively comes to you, because they can't physically come to you because they're in prison, and says, look, I'm innocent. What do you guys do?
Yeah, so usually they write to us or they call on the payphone, the prison payphone, and say, you know, I'm innocent. And we send them a 10-page questionnaire that they fill out. They'll complete it with their version of the facts of the case, and they'll also include their attorney information, the county of their conviction, whether they're claiming factual innocence of all involvement, or maybe they're claiming that they're only innocent of one thing. So they'll submit that questionnaire. We'll take a look at it, make sure that they've been convicted in Southern California, they're claiming factual innocence. We make sure that they're still in prison. Sometimes people apply and they're no longer in custody.
So you don't clear people who've already served their terms and just want to be kind of exonerated?
Not typically, and the reason is because there's just so many people in prison that that are still locked up that
right.
don't have their freedom, and we just don't have the resources to go through all of the cases for those that are out. So we do focus on people that are in, and so once they've submitted their questionnaire, we go through that. We'll then reach out to them and ask them to submit one of the first documents that's filed once they're on appeal. It is called the appellant's opening brief. The reason we request that is because an appellate lawyer somewhere in the state has read through the entire trial record of what happened at the trial, and they summarize it into this perfect little statement of facts, and it tells us kind of big picture what happened in the case. So instead of getting 2,000 pages of transcripts, we get a 5 or 10 page summary of how this person got convicted. We then usually either we'll have a volunteer student or a volunteer lawyer will read through the questionnaire and the appellant's opening brief. They'll write up a memo and say, yeah, I think this guy could be innocent, or no, I don't think there's any chance this person's innocent. And sometimes, too, like the inmates will submit additional new evidence of their innocence. I mean, we ask for it in their questionnaire, and if they have it, they'll submit it. And so we'll take that into account. And so,
Michael, we got a break coming up. Let's finish that on the other side. You're listening to the Dave Congleton Show, KVEC News Talk 920 AM, 96.5 FM. Get in on the conversation. Give us a call, 805-543-8830. Matt Hoy in for Dave Congleton. Dave will be back on Monday. I'm looking forward to the weekend. I have a hammock that just needs to be put back out on my back deck, and I am going to enjoy that.
Yes.
We've got Michael Semenchik. Am I pronouncing that right?
It's Semenchik, but
Semenchik.
It
could be worse. I substitute teach sometimes, and I swear parents have named their children, spelled their children's names in such a way as to torture me. So before we went to break, you were talking about the process by which someone kind of applies to get your help, and you said they fill out a form, and you get a summary of what happened at trial. Go on from there.
So then we'll have a volunteer write us a memo and tell us this is a case you should take or this is a case you shouldn't take. Someone on staff will go through that memo, and then if we think it's something that deserves another look, then we'll assign it to one of our clinic students for investigation. So we have, in an academic year, we'll have 12 to 15 clinic students. They're law students here at Cal Western. They'll go out and they'll have 10 cases assigned to them. It's their job to figure out, is this person innocent and can I prove it? And, they're going to the prisons, they're tracking down witnesses, they're trying to figure out the case, and then they're supervised by lawyers in our office. And ultimately, if they come up with evidence of innocence, then we'll work with the student works with the lawyer to put together the legal documents to file and get them out.
So how long does that process usually take from them applying with you to you coming to a decision, and then from if you decide to go on with it to them, you know, to you proving their innocence and them being released? How long is that kind of typically take? I realize it can vary widely.
Yeah, it does vary widely. I mean, on the DNA cases, I think it's a lot quicker because it's sometimes as simple as let's order a new test, and then, you know, a couple of years later, then we're getting results and we're getting them out of prison. But in some of the non-DNA cases, which are a lot of the cases that we have, it can take years. And so the average time nationwide actually is 16 and a half years for somebody to be in prison before they've been exonerated. And we've had some of those cases. I mean, we have Michael Handline was a Ventura County case. He was in prison for 36 years before we were able to get his conviction reversed. Bill Richards was 23 years out of San Bernardino. But we have cases like Rafael Madrigal, who's spent 9 years in prison before we got him out. Usually the inmates are writing to us soon after they've been convicted and their appeal becomes final. So that's usually about 2 years after their conviction becomes final. And then it just depends on the case. So some are as 4 to 6 years, I would say, for us to do it. And then, like in Handline's case, he was one of the first people that wrote to us back in 1999. We didn't get him out until 2014. So it took us 15 years to find the evidence that had been hidden by the prosecution.
You're listening to The Dave Conklin Show. We're talking with Michael Semanchik, the managing attorney at the California Innocence Project. Give us a call if you've got questions, 805-543-8830 or 1-800-549-5832. Now, you just mentioned something that is kind of near and dear to my heart in a very frustrating way. You mentioned the evidence the prosecutor had hidden from the defense attorneys. How, I mean, of all the things that you see where someone has been wrongfully convicted, how often is that what happened?
It's hard to know because, you know, I don't know what I don't know. And so, I mean, there's probably cases out there where we've exonerated the person, and there could have been some evidence the prosecution had always withheld and continues to withhold. Because we don't have, you know, it's not like we're not a state where everything that the prosecution has, they're required to turn over. And it's not full open discovery. And it's actually even more limited for us. When you're in trial, the prosecution turns over everything they've got, and they're supposed to turn anything over that's favorable to the defense. That's what Brady versus Maryland requires. And California now has a new law that says if you withhold evidence of innocence as a prosecutor, that's a felony. And so that's awesome. That's great. I'm super happy that we have that law.
Has anybody been prosecuted under that law?
No, that's a fresh law, so I don't think we'll see that probably for some years, but I do think we will see that at some point. But you know, we don't know what we don't know, and so whatever they're hiding, I'm not going to probably ever find out about it. And in our situation in post-conviction, what we end up doing is we battle to get a copy of the file. Whatever they turned over to the defense at trial, that's not available to us. We have to ask the defense attorney, and quite frankly, there's been a lot of floods, a lot of fires that defense attorneys have suffered over the years and lost files. If the defense attorney doesn't keep it and they return it to the inmate, then, you know, it's usually been sitting in a prison cell for, you know, 5-10 years, and a lot of times it's an incomplete file by the time we get it. And so it's really hard to piece together these cases without open discovery, you know, outside of the trial process.
So is that something that can be fixed? I assume that's something that sounds like it can be fixed with a law. Is there anybody in the state legislature who's on your side trying to push for that sort of thing?
Yeah, you know, we just changed just last year. We changed, so there is a law that it's Penal Code Section 1054.9 required that anybody that's sentenced to death or life without parole, if we make a showing, we, the Innocence Project, makes a showing that we can't get the file from the trial attorney or the defendant themselves, that the prosecution has to turn it over. Now, counties like Los Angeles that are huge, they put the costs on to us. Mm. So I would have to pay a paralegal from the L.A. District Attorney's Office to copy their file and pay for the copies. And so that's not cheap. No, it's not. And so we have to litigate those cases too. So, you know, it usually takes some time to get to the point where they have to turn it over. But that law was just extended to apply to people that get life sentences. And so anybody that's sentenced to 15 to life or 25 to life, we now can fight to get, but I still have to litigate, and I still have to pay a paralegal in some counties, and I have to pay for copy fees. So getting access to the evidence is a huge issue that we face, and it takes a long time. So,
of those 2,000 or so requests for help that you get every year, how many of them does your initial look through say, you know what, we think this person's guilty? How many of them are, they may be innocent, but there's probably no way we could prove it? And how many do you take and start the process with?
Well, so, yeah, a lot of them, I'd say actually the number that we were just setting aside, not going to take a look at all, is probably about 80% of the 2,000. And that is a mix of there's no way we're ever going to prove it, and I think that person's definitely guilty. So only about 20% of them are we actually going to assign for further investigation. And in a given year, we're able to go move through 100 to 150 cases on a really, if we have a really good group of clinic students, we might move through, a little bit more than that. And so, it's tough because we definitely are developing a backlog, and we need resources to process through more of these cases and put up these fights to try to get access to the information. So,
okay. We're going to take another break. Before we do that, if people want to help the California Innocence Project, where can they go and what can they do?
They can go to CaliforniaInnocenceProject.org and hit that donate button in the top right. Not the donut button, but the donate button, top right. It's nice and red. You can't miss it.
If they send you donuts, you wouldn't turn them down, though.
I wouldn't turn down donuts,
okay.
But I also wouldn't turn down $20 or $5 or whatever anybody can send would be helpful for us to free the next innocent person.
Okay, we're talking to Michael Semanchik, Managing Attorney, California Innocence Project. Last opportunity, if you want to get in on the conversation, 805-543-8830, 1-800-549-5832. You're listening to the Dave Congleton Show on News Talk 920 AM, 96.5 FM KVEC. You're listening to Matt Hoy on the Dave Congleton Show. Dave will be back Monday. We're talking with Michael Semanchik. He is the Managing Attorney, California Innocence Project. Last chance to get in on the phone calls, 805-543-8830, 1-800-549-5832. Can you tell listeners kind of what was, some of the current cases you're working on and where you feel they went wrong in the prosecutions that got what you believe to be some innocent people stuck behind bars?
Sure. And by the way, you can check out our current cases on our website. If you go CaliforniaInnocenceProject.org and then look under current cases, you'll see a list of all of the cases that we've agreed to work on, and we're filing in court on them. So looking at that list, we've got Kira Newsom. This is a case that we've been working on for a number of years. She was convicted of a shooting in Los Angeles. She was 19 years old at the time. She was in an adult school after high school, continuing education class. Mm-hmm. She was actually in this class. They take attendance about every 15 minutes, and she's in this classroom. She had done all of her homework and assignments that day, and she's in this classroom from, I think, 12 till 1:30. And right in the middle of that time frame, this shooting goes down. And an eyewitness says that it's Kira that does the shooting, and she ultimately goes down for it, despite the fact that her teacher says, no, I'm 100% sure that Kira was in class all day, and others that said that she was there at school, and you know, proof that her homework had been done, and so you know, that's it's eyewitness misidentification is the leading cause of wrongful convictions in DNA cases. It's actually in 70% of the cases, and it's just that we have this belief that we see something that we can replay it like a video camera,
right?
And that's just not true. We just get it wrong. We're not as good as we think we are, and all of the exonerations we've had in this country have certainly shown that we're not good at remembering people that we see, especially in high intensity situations like crimes, especially shootings.
Okay, so what? That's kind of the evidence you've got to support her innocence. What? How is? It sounds like that was presented. That defense was presented at her original trial. So, what are you doing now to kind of push back against that?
So we've come up with an alternative suspect that has gone on to do a number of other crimes and fit the general description from the witnesses, also had a beef with the individuals that were shot at, and so it's kind of packaging that all up and presenting that.
Oh, okay. Okay, very interesting. So you said eyewitness identification is the number one kind of bad example. Or the thing that gets people, behind bars. And I'm guessing the thing that most often gets people out of it is DNA, that we are at the point where if you've got DNA evidence that's, that would exonerate you, the process would seem to be pretty streamlined to get somebody out, right?
Yeah, it just depends on the case, really. If it's a case where somebody has recently been convicted, and then the DNA technology might have already existed, and so then it just becomes a question of like, well, did they test in the right places? Mm-hmm. Did they compare to the right people? Did they have a proper expert take a look at it? I mean, evidence, the DNA testing has continued to improve. I would say about every 3 years, a new kit or a new way of doing the testing comes out, and it's always getting more and more discriminatory, meaning you hear the bigger numbers when they're testifying at trial, but it's also getting better. It's getting to the point where you can almost get a full profile from a single cell, and so that results in complicated mixtures where you've got multiple people in any given sample, and interpreting that is actually extremely difficult, and trying to make a call as to whether somebody is the person or is not the person. We almost have too much information now when it comes to DNA testing, and so DNA is one of the, I'd say it's the best criminal justice tool that's ever happened. I mean, it's better than fingerprints. It's light years better than fingerprints. But we've actually got to such a level that now we're getting these complicated mixtures that too much information is kind of going against us.
Why is it light years better than fingerprints?
Well, fingerprints have problems, and the main problem with fingerprints is that what you're doing is you're taking usually a degraded sample from a scene. Mm-hmm. So you don't usually get these perfect prints at the scene of a crime. There's
smudges.
You might get a partial print,
right.
Or it's not going to be pristine. It might have a smudge on it, and it's not like you go and maybe you have to do a criminal background check and you perfectly put your prints in the card. Usually what you're getting from a crime scene is not the most ideal thing. And then you take that and you're supposed to compare that to some sample. And when you're doing that comparison, there's a human involved in that. They first put it into a computer system that returns similarities, and you get a list, and it's like, okay, well, here's like the top 10 closest to the fingerprint that you submitted. Mm-hmm. Here's the next 10 after that, and here's the next 10 after that. And a human has to sit there and say, okay, looking and comparing the one that I got from the crime scene to the one on this computer, they have to make a subjective call. And so there's some variation there, and it's not as exact. And with DNA, you're getting these exact numbers that are correlating to specific people. And so it's better than relying on the eyeballs of a human.
Okay. Yeah, another thing you've got on your website that I noticed, and this is one of my bugaboos, so I want you to kind of hit people over the head with this one too, bite mark evidence.
Yes. Yeah, so there's been 25 or 30 bite mark exonerations nationwide. Essentially, what the process is, and I caution anyone that's listening to really challenge forensic science whenever you're sitting on a jury. Bite mark evidence for the longest time was paraded around as this amazing thing that these dental experts, these dentists could go around and take a bruise that may be a bite on a victim and compare it to a mold of a suspect's teeth. And experts were getting up and testifying with no statistics. They would get up and say, I'm positive to the exclusion of all others that the bruises left on this victim's body are from the teeth of this specific person. And that is just nonsense. There is no way that you can tell that it's definitely from that person. I'll tell you one way you can tell, though, not from looking at the bruising and not from looking at a suspect's teeth, but swabbing where that bite allegedly happened and doing a DNA test. So, there's been a number of wrongful convictions based on that junk science, and for the most part, I think we're starting to put a stop to experts testifying and using that in cases, but I would, if you're looking for a case to read about,
that concerns me because it seems to me like it should have been stopped a few years ago.
Yeah, I'd say in the big counties where criminal convictions are happening regularly, it's for the most part done. It's some of the smaller locations that maybe aren't up to speed on the level of forensic science and where it should be nationwide. Those are the ones I'm still concerned about. Mm-hmm. But look at the Bill Richards case for a case example. He went to trial three times. On the fourth time, they introduced a bite mark expert. That expert, some years later, finally came back and recanted and said, I'm not even sure that was a bite mark at all on the victim. And it's like, we relied on that to convict this person and put him in prison for 25 to life.
Wow. Okay. Getting back to kind of death penalty cases. I think on TV this morning, Governor Newsom was there, and he said that it's a racist system. You cannot deny that. Is the death penalty, is who's chosen for the death to be tried, as a death penalty case, and the conviction of those people, is it a racist system?
Definitely. I mean, all you have to do is go to the LA Times had an interesting piece they put together. It's a picture database of every single person on California's death row. Scroll through that. The majority of people you're going to be seeing, the faces you're going to be seeing, are exactly what Governor Newsom said. They're black and brown. And it's no doubt that that our system continues to have that play out. We always look at the new laws that are coming out, the victims' rights laws, mm-hmm. and quite honestly, the names of the laws that actually get, or the laws that get names, they're always named after younger white victims, and the perpetrator in those cases are typically African American males, and you can think back to all of them. I mean, it's not always African-American males that do it, but it's a large portion of them are. And, and that's just been the history of this country. But I would say go to the LA Times article that they put together and flip through the pictures, because the pictures show exactly what, he's talking about.
Is that just confined to the death penalty, or is our criminal justice system as a whole racist as well?
No, it's not just the death penalty. It's definitely on the system on a whole.
Okay, I'll confess to you, I can understand the decision by prosecutors and pointing to who they choose to apply the death penalty to, that there could be some racist judgments in that. But there's one of those guys on death row that I know he belongs there because he killed a cop, and that cop's wife was in my Bible study down in San Diego. Mm-hmm. And he left behind a six-month-old son that never got to meet his dad. And I just – it's cases like that where, at least for me, I feel like we still should have the death penalty. I am going to allow you to wrap up. What should people remember? What should people be thinking about? And how can they help your project?
Yeah, I'm not saying that any of the 737 people, and the majority of the people on death row are guilty, and I'm not trying to say that they're all innocent, but for the 4 to 10% that are, we owe them the ability to prove that their innocence, and when it takes these long periods of time to actually find the evidence of innocence, we shouldn't trust the system, we shouldn't trust that that everyone is guilty, and for that reason, I think we should have everybody with life without parole.
Michael, thanks for coming on. You've been listening to the Dave Conklin Show, News Talk 920 AM. Okay.